hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us some high school students. We have Middleton High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. And we also have students from Monroe High School. Would they stand, please? And thank you for coming a slightly farther distance. These students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. In this program, the students are sent an invitation to join us for an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they are then sent briefs in the case we are about to hear, and may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come to oral argument, and then they meet with a justice of the Supreme Court at noon, or at least after the second case is argued. And everyone is invited to join the justice and the students at that time. They discuss the procedures of the court in taking and hearing the case and deciding the case, but not the substantive issues involved in the case. Now, we have summaries of the two cases we are about to hear this morning relating to underinsured motorist coverage. And if anyone does not have a synopsis or doesn't have the briefs, if you would like that, the marshal will distribute it. So if you raise your right or left hand, the marshal will bring a summary to you. Okay. With those preliminary remarks, let me just now introduce the justices of the court to you. Starting on my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and she is the justice with whom you're going to meet after the second argument. To her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Pat Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. With those introductions made, we'll call our first case, which is 2003 AP 2482, State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company versus Travis Bailey. We will first hear from Attorney Thomas E. Goss, who represents State Farm. Mr. Goss.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This is a case that once again addresses the question of reducing clauses, the validity of those clauses, and in particular, the type of reductions that a underinsured motorist may apply against any payment made under the coverage part. Specifically, what we're looking at today with regard to State Farm's appeal is whether an underinsured motorist is entitled to reduce from the UIM limit payments made by or on behalf of a non-underinsured tortfeasor. State Farm's position, quite simply put, is it absolutely can. That's sanctioned, that result is sanctioned both by virtue of the statute 632.32 sub 5I1, which is clear and unambiguous, and State Farm's policy language tracking that statute. My remarks this morning, I'd like to focus on three areas. First, what is the correct purpose of UIM coverage in light of statutorily sanctioned reducing clauses? Secondly, looking at the statute itself in terms of the clarity of the statute in providing for these reductions, and, of course, State Farm's policy tracking that. The third area will be the contextual ambiguity issue, which is really a matter of Mr. Bailey's cross-appeal.
One, two, and three. Two is purpose, three is contextual ambiguity, and one is?
One is purpose, Your Honor. Oh. Two is the statute itself, ambiguity with regard to the statute and the policy, and then three, right.
Thank you.
And it is fundamentally, in analyzing these issues, one must have a proper understanding of the purpose of UIM coverage. This Court, very recently in Welling case, provided that clarity. Prior decisions, however, really didn't, and there's a reason it didn't, because the issues in that case typically only involved a payment made by an underinsured motorist. That was the only thing that was involved. You weren't talking about other liability payments. You weren't talking about workers' compensation payments. You weren't talking about disability payments that could be applied. And that distinction was important. In Welland, this Court stated, we have explained numerous times that the insured's purpose in purchasing a UIM policy is to purchase a predetermined fixed level of UIM recovery that is arrived at by combining payments from all sources. That is the purpose in light of statutorily authorized reducing clauses.
Now, that case didn't involve an insured motorist either. That is, it was only an underinsured motorist.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. The Welland case. The Welland case, the facts basically had to do with the insurer trying to apply a payment made to others other than the
And the court said, no, you can't do that. You just have to look at this victim and this underinsured. Right.
And in reaching that, though, the court emphasized it because the argument that the insurer was making in Welland would not provide the insurer with a predetermined fixed level of recovery. And that's what I'm saying. And that's why it is so important to keep that. What happened was, in the past, courts were saying the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage was to put the insured in the same position the insured would have occupied if the underinsured motorist's liability limit had been equal to the UIM limit selected by the insured. There's the trouble. And that's what happened with the Court of Appeals in this case, because they locked on that. And they said, State Farm, you're not entitled to take that reduction for the payment made by the non-underinsured motorist, because that would frustrate the purpose. It wouldn't put the insured in the same position the insured would be.
One of the problems, and I went back and I reread Whalen and I reread these other cases, the problem is that Whalen focuses on limits to limits versus limits to damages. And when you read Whalen, you have to read it that way. When you read these other cases, you're not necessarily into that issue. And each of these cases raised somewhat different issues. So to take language out of a case and then try and apply it to a totally different fact situation. Who was thinking of that fact situation in Whalen? None of the parties. Maybe the court was omnipotent and not, well, it is omnipotent.
No, maybe.
Omniscient.
Yeah.
Maybe
omnipotent
it's omniscient. You know what I'm trying to say. So when I reread Whalen in light of Bailey and Maratz, and there's a footnote in one of the Maratz, I think it's the Maratz brief that talks about Whalen. You have to remember that it doesn't say the purpose is not to put the guy in the same position as if he was dealing with an insured tortfeasor. But we were talking about limits to limits versus limits to damages.
Now, but in this case, Your Honor, State Farm's policy is limits to limits.
I understand
so that. That would apply. And so you're right. I mean, the type one type of coverage that the court had identified and discussed, I think, in Dauhauer, Taylor, and Schmitz talked about where you had the limits to damages type of coverage, which is what State Farm's policy in this case did do prior to the endorsement to that coverage, which made it a limits to limits at the time of the accident itself. So it, but the purpose has to be to provide a fixed level of recovery in light of, because if you...
Against an underinsured motorist. That's the issue in this case.
place.
It's limits to limits, but the issue is, do you look at it only against the underinsured motorist, or do you look at everybody? And Whalen said, no, you only look at this victim.
Right. And the Bailey court was wrong because, in light of the statutorily authorized reducing clauses, you look at the whole thing.
That's your position.
That's my position. That's my position, Your Honor.
What should we do with, you quote from the Whalen case. Good case. Good case written by a good justice. Mm-hmm. You can look at the Teschendorf case, which came out later than the Whalen case. But it talks about purpose differently. You know, it says, among other things, that the uninsured motorist coverage seeks to compensate an insured who is the victim of an uninsured motorist negligence to the same extent as if the uninsured motorist were insured. You know, so my point is simply this. It seems to me you can pick and choose language from lots of cases, including Dauhauer. I can give you language to fit a couple of arguments from Dauhauer, and perhaps in Schmitz, and perhaps in Landridge. So why should we take your excerpt from Whalen as opposed to more recent cases or this case or the discussion of purpose in the next case we'll be hearing, Marat's, which isn't what you're proffering? Why should we take yours?
Because it's the correct position, Your Honor. And, okay. And that's really what Teschendorf did. They flip-flop. And the Court's going back to these prior cases that really the facts were the only payment that applied was the underinsured motorist. And what I'm saying is, in light of statutorily sanctioned reducing clauses, you have to consider all sources. If you state that, like you did in Whalen, that covers everything. And that provides all parties, courts, with an accurate assessment in which to gauge the right of any insurer to take these reductions. Because if you don't, because again, you can see the problem in this case was the Court of Appeals was right. I mean, if you accept that the notion that the purpose is to place the insurer in the same position he or she would have been had the tortfeasor's limits been the same as the UIN limits, it stands to reason. You can only take the reduction for the underinsured motorist. Of course, the problem with that is, you couldn't take the reduction for the for the workers' compensation payments. You couldn't take it for the disability payments because that wouldn't place the insured in the same position either. The same is true with regard to other liability payments that the statute clearly allows. So it is absolutely critical that this Court, once and for all, identify the proper purpose and apply it consistently. And again, I understand why the Court did, because again, in the context of the particular case, if you're just looking at one thing, it can be a convenient shorthand. But the Court needs to clarify and explain. This is what this case presents, an opportunity to do that. I think once the Court does that, we'll go a long way in terms of being able to get a better handle on this type of issue, which can be very perplexing for all parties. With regard to the statute itself, the key point in this is that I'm focusing on is sub 1 of 632.32 sub 5 sub I, which permits a reduction for amounts paid by or on behalf of any person or organization that may be legally responsible for the bodily injury or death for which the payment is made. And that's any person organization. Doesn't say payment made by the underinsured motorist or the underinsured motorist. The legislature clearly could, if it would be limited to that extent, which is what Bailey wants you to adopt. But that's not what it says. Any is an inclusive, all-inclusive word. It's not exclusive.
Well, let's look at that statute. I've grown to really like this statute. And I know that the legislature never does anything that's superfluous. You know, language has meaning. That's one of the fun things about this job. Language has meaning. What does "for which the payment is made" mean?
For which the payment is made, Your Honor, means that the payment has to be made.
Let me break it down. I'm sorry. What payment are they talking about?
I'm talking about the payment that's made by a tortfeasor, any tortfeasor.
Why isn't it payment made by the UIM insurer?
That's the way I read it.
Right. That would be, I think, an incorrect reading, Your Honor, because, and this is the, this is, and Waddell in his brief in the Moratz case made that point. And they were arguing for State Farm in that case as well. I just read it last night in preparation for my comments this morning. And that is an improper approach in this case.
Well, it may be an improper approach. It may be all wet. I'm just saying that when I looked at that statute and looked at that statute, and everyone neglects that phrase. The majority opinion here neglects that phrase. In your policy, when you paraphrase the statute, you neglect that phrase. In the Moratz opinion, Judge Dykman doesn't mention that phrase. They always quote the statute, and they stop without mentioning that phrase.
Yeah.
And you agree, and you're nodding, and you agree with my observation. And I've looked at that, and I think it means payment by the UIN insurer for which payment is made. I say to myself, what payment by whom? What kind of payment are they talking about? Made by the UIM insurer. And then for which? What are they talking about? Well, it's for the tort liability for bodily injury caused by the UIM. We're talking about UIM insurance, okay? And what kind of payment is made under UIM insurance, at least heretofore? It's payment for an uninsured motorist driver and the actions of that uninsured motorist driver.
Right. The problem with that approach, Your Honor, is that it assumes that the UIM insurer is going to make a payment. And that's an assumption a court can't make. And the legislature obviously didn't make that assumption either because it applied certain reductions that could be taken. So these reductions apply, and if they're enforced, there may not be any payment made.
Where does that language come from? When you look at Justice Prosser's opinion in Teschendorf in paragraphs 50, 51, 52, 53, it talks about, and in your briefs too, you cite Teschendorf in his recitation of legislative history. It talks about the letter from the Insurance Alliance, written by Eric Englund, and asking for certain language. And the language requested, at least in the Teschendorf opinion, stops at responsible for bodily injury and death, and it doesn't have for which payment is made. How did that get in there?
I think the reason why it got in there is to clarify that the type of payments that could be applied as a reduction are those payments that are made to the insured.
And I'm asking more from a historical point of view. I know what your argument is, but when was that added and by whom?
That was added, according to the legislative history, I can't say when, but that was added at the tail end after the letter. Initially, it did not have that language, and then the legislature included that. And I think it's an important limitation, because I do disagree with you that State Farm's policy doesn't have it, because if you look at State Farm's reducing clause, it says the amount paid to the insured by or on behalf of a person. And that's what I'm saying. It's got to be paid to the insured, Your Honor, because the statute requires the same thing. And what happens is, by saying that, and when we talk about ambiguity, it has to be reasonable. It has to be two reasonable interpretations. If the interpretation of one party offered isn't reasonable, there is no ambiguity. And in this particular case, Your Honor, I don't think you can read that subsection 1, that for bodily injury, death for which payment is made, as referring to a payment made by the underinsured motorist carrier. Because,
well,
again, that assumes...
I might be unreasonable in that, but I wasn't thinking of who wins or who loses or who gains by it. I thought, what does this mean? I said, for which the payment is made is a qualifying phrase. That means it's a limiting phrase. It is a phrase that modifies. What does it modify? You know, I used to be an English teacher, and so that's the way. I mean, I wasn't saying who wins, who loses. I'm saying, what does this mean, and what purpose does it serve in this statute? It has to mean something, and it has to have some purpose, and it was added after the Insurance Alliance request, apparently. What does it mean?
What it means is the payment must be made for the bodily injury or death for which the payment is made. A little circular, I realize, but what it means, Your Honor, is basically that in order to take the reduction, the payment has to be made to the insured. Because if we stop and just say amounts paid by or on behalf of any person or organization that may be liable and stop it right there, then you're in Teschendorf and your problem saying, well, does this mean that if he paid another person, a passenger in the car, I can apply that against your reduction? No, it doesn't. Why? Because it has to pertain to the bodily injury or death for which the payment is made, which would be the insured in that particular case. And that's what, with that language.
Could be. I mean, I start a little earlier. I start in sub 1 because you're talking about the limits can be reduced by any. And again, Justice Prosser talks about the addition of the word any after the Insurance Alliance recommendation. And that, he says in paragraph 53 of Teschendorf, that's meant to be restrictive. That is a protection against deductions that do not apply. And so I'm talking about the words, rather, that apply, not any. By any of the following, that apply. That was added afterwards. And so I see it as you can limit. Or arguably, I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying I was trying to read it, and because no one's telling me what that means. Limits can be reduced by any of the following that apply. And then we go to one, and they can be reduced by the amounts paid on or behalf of any person or organization that may be legally responsible for bodily injury or death. And then it says, for which payment is made. And I can say, well, what kind of payments? Payments made by the insurance company, because we're talking about the insurance company contract, the UIM contract, and payments made pursuant to that contract. And they make payments that they're supposed to make for the actions of the underinsured tortfeasor. That doesn't work for you.
But again, Your Honor, I think the problem is that the legislature clearly had to know that there are going to be situations where there will be no payment made. And so it would contemplate that by applying the authorized statutory reductions. And where logically it's not going to follow that if you're going to say that refers to payments made by the on behalf of the underinsured motorist carrier, you couldn't make that connection. So to me, it could only reasonably be construed with regard to payments made to the insured. If you're going to apply that against the reducing, the payment must be made to the insured. And really, the Welland Court said that in awesome terms. Page 46.
Well, let me tell you, I'm going to get you. You're saying it's only payments made, what did you say?
To the insured. That could be the payments.
To the insured, but that's not, you don't use to. For which? There's a different meaning in for which from to. Okay.
Yeah, but it says for the bodily injury or death for which payment is made. Bodily injury or death. It's the bodily injury or death at hand. In other words, I can't, if there's another passenger who's injured, I can't apply, that tells me I can't apply a liability payment for another passenger's claim. Arguably couldn't even do it for a derivative claim, for society companionship. It's what's paid for the bodily injury to the insured itself, himself, herself. And the court in Welland stated, and again, Welland had to do with they had a 300,000 UIM limit, two claimants, the split payments were made. The insurer argued that, hey, we can apply the entire underlying limit, even though our insurer didn't only obtain 250 of the 300,000. The court said no. And that why? Because the court looked at 632.32 sub 5I1, and it says, which limits the reduction to amounts paid by the tortfeasor's insurer for the bodily injury for which the payment is made. It went on. Paragraph 52 to note that in supporting this conclusion, It said, furthermore, plants recovery would be reduced by an amount not permitted under 632 sub 5 sub I. And again, that's what that provision does. It ensures that the only reduction that can be taken for any liability payments are those that are actually made to the insured, not anyone else. And it can't be reasonably construed as applying to payments made by the underinsured motorist, because there may not be any. And then what happens? It evaporates. It means nothing. And you can't construe statutes in that manner. There are also claims that Waddell raises that somehow there's there's a common law right to striking down reducing clauses. I take strong issue with that. In the past, the courts have struck down those clauses mainly on the former anti-stacking statute based on 631.43, and there's no common law rights under UIM contracts. Largely creatures of statute, at least controlled by statute, not to the extent of UIM coverage, but there. So again, they want to give that twist because then you can apply a strict construction. There's no reason to do that here because there is no ambiguity. You apply the statute as written on its face, and it's very clear. And I think the legislative history, for whatever relevance it is, and I don't think it is relevant because I don't look at the statute as being ambiguous, it can confirm that fact, shows that it includes amounts paid by persons who are legally responsible. And the court in Dauhauer said that, a tortfeasor. I mean, you can't say, well, geez, well, look at this, and it must mean an underinsured motorist in one instance, and yet when we're talking about a non-underinsured motorist tortfeasor, it must mean something.
Let me ask you this. See if my interpretation of your position is correct. Your position is that there are multiple tortfeasors. Some fit under the definition of underinsured because their policy limits are equal to or less than the passengers here. And if the victim gets paid at least the amount of the underinsured policy, here, what was that, 25?
Here it was 25, it was a 50 UIM policy, correct.
Okay. From anybody, the UIM coverage is gone.
That's right.
Right? So they might have had damage of $1 million with medicals or more, right?
Right.
And there's a tortfeasor that has an insurance policy of $80,000. That's a bad number, $100,000. And pays policy limits. And everybody else has the same policy limits as the UIM coverage. So the victim collects $100,000 and nothing else. That's your position?
If I understand the court correctly, I don't think it would in that case. I mean, if you have a million, you're saying $1 million UIM?
Damages. $1 million in damages.
Oh.
You got 50,000 UIM, some tortfeasor who has insurance, there are multiple tortfeasors, some are underinsured,
some
are uninsured.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Once that limit has been paid, then
so
the purpose has
been
met.
So the purpose pays $100,000, you're off the hook.
That's
State
right.
State firms off the hook.
Right. Because the purpose is to provide a fixed, predetermined level of recovery that's arrived at by combining payments made from all sources. And that, in the court's example, that purpose has been met.
Well, that's a good-sounding purpose when you have one underinsured tortfeasor. Yeah, another problem here. Wellen also said the underlying purpose of the underinsured motorist statute is to allow UIM policies that furnish and insured a predetermined fixed level of coverage for an accident from a combination of the tortfeasor's insurance and the UIM insurance. And you're reading the tortfeasor to mean any tortfeasor, not a UIM tortfeasor.
Right. And again, in Welland, that was, there was only one underinsured motor tortfeasor. Exactly right.
Okay.
And I think paragraph 51, where they talks about the purpose, because the court, I think, in Welland referred back to Schmitz, where he said that, I think the example they used, that if you want to have $200,000 in UIM protection, that's what you buy, and you're guaranteed that. If you want more, you buy more. And to ensure that you're protected. But it gives you a predetermined fixed level of recovery.
Mr. Goss, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Your red light is on.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Goss. Mrs. Rand, you represent Mr. Bailey, Travis Bailey.
Court, please. There were two petitions that the court accepted in respect to this case. The petition submitted by Bailey again raised the issue as to what constitutes contextual ambiguity and has Folkman created some confusion in respect to the impact of the preceding Schmitz case. In that regard, it's clearly our position. We think that's exactly what has occurred. Clearly some of the, or at least one of the, appellate court judges has suggested that Folkman was a retreat from Schmitz. And I found that troublesome in the sense that there were no dissents in Folkman. If there had been any significant retreat, I would have thought that some member of this court might have had a dissenting opinion. I concluded that Schmitz, as Folkman said, was still very good law. And the concept is that a policy must clearly state what the insured is getting. And I came to the conclusion that the use of the words crystal clear, the court felt may have been too strong. And therefore, those words were withdrawn, and the Schmitz decision stood without any modification. Dealing with the State Farm policy, I think perhaps is truly unique in a number of respects. The body of the policy described a reduction based upon damages. There was an endorsement that changed the reducing provision as to reducing from, quote, policy limits. I think clearly, and it's troubling, I believe, the use of the word limits. In sections preceding UIM and UM, the word limits means limits, a maximum or minimum amount, unqualifiably. And suddenly you come to provisions related to UM and UIM, and limit doesn't mean limit. It's now a departure point, a starting point from which something is going to be subtracted, if you're dealing certainly with UIM, to arrive at a number, if any, if counsel is correct, that permits the amount to be recovered. The other unique part of the policy, the Bailey policy, was that State Farm submitted a declaration page from 2 years preceding the accident. and which was not in force at the time of the accident. It referred to an endorsement for UM and UIM, and described it as a UIM endorsement. However, it also said that that endorsement was not effective until the next policy period. The only other document that comes anywhere close to approaching a declaration page in this case was the automobile renewal form, which has no references to any endorsement, increases the UIM from $25,000 to $50,000 to $100,000. The endorsement itself does not contain all provisions of UIM coverage. For example, the description of what UIM coverage is, and which describes it as an amount that will be paid based upon the liability of the underinsured up to the policy limits, and the policy limits can be found, it says, on the declaration page. So if there was a declaration page at that time, that would have been $50,000 to $100,000, and that is where the insurer is led. In the same respect, paragraph 1 under limits of liability does not appear in the endorsement. And that paragraph also says that the amount of coverage is the amount stated on the declaration page. Now, any insured going through the document has to flip back and forth between these pages and somehow figure out, and maybe even observe, there's a difference from damages to limits. One word, not highlighted in any respect. There's also a provision in the body of the policy, but not in the endorsement, as to how the amount will be calculated, and which deals with two factors. One, negligence or causal negligence, and two, the amount of damages. There is nothing whatsoever in that portion of the policy dealing with a determination of what amounts have been paid.
Counsel, I'm looking at your appendix.
Yes.
Yes. At page 201.
Excuse me, what page?
201. I think it's the policy in effect. That's one of my first questions. And then I talk about the language. Got it? Paragraph 201 on.
Are you looking at my appendix or the other appendix?
I'm looking at Goss's appendix. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the defendants. I apologize to you.
I have it in my appendix.
Okay, well, I don't care where it is. I'm assuming it's the same language. If it's not, then we can talk about that, too.
It's page 125.
Justice Wilcox says it's 125 in your brief. It says, this is Section 3, uninsured and underinsured coverage. Then under underinsured, we will pay damages for bodily injury an insured is legally entitled to collect from the owner of an underinsured motor vehicle. The bodily injury must be caused by accident arising out of the operation or use of an underinsured motor vehicle. So you, the policy seems to me to say that they're going to pay damages that the underinsured motor vehicle would have paid. Right?
I believe so.
That's what it seems to say. And it has to be the bodily injury has to be caused by the underinsured motor vehicle. That fits. But then the reduction language, there's no coverage until the limits of liability of all bodily injury bonds and policies that apply have been used up by payment of judgments or settlement. Now, if I understand Mrs. Durgas's argument, and he can respond if I'm wrong, that means any judgment or settlement by any tortfeasor. Is that the way you understand his argument?
That's certainly what he's arguing, and my answer to that is the language you've referred to. Are you now referring to paragraph 1 of coverage W on page, what would be 202 of that?
202, paragraph 1.
The amount of coverage?
Yep, that's one, but there's big language in all cases, right after the language I read to you saying that they're going to pay what the underinsured would have paid, what you're entitled to collect from the underinsured. But then there's in caps, so it really must be important, although it's not italicized and it's not bold the way the other language is. There's no coverage until the limits of liability of all bodily injury liability bonds and policies that apply have been used up by payments of judgments or settlement. Seems to me that should only refer to underinsured motor vehicle.
I'm sorry. I've been having some difficulty.
Well, I'm having difficulty talking.
I'm having difficulty hearing your voice. Well, I'm sorry.
No, it's my fault, counsel. I'm saying that the language on 201 is capitalized right after the definition.
Yes.
And the question is whether that language is limited to the underinsured motor vehicle or is limited or it goes to all tortfeasors. And as I understand Mr. Goss's argument, it goes to all tortfeasors. It's the same language as on 202, essentially.
I think the various points in this policy, excepting for the reducing provision itself, my belief is that any reasonable insured would understand that to mean that the coverage is, number one, what's paid by an underinsured and only by an underinsured, and the amount of coverage is the amount stated on the declaration page.
Counselor, if both of the drivers in this accident, both Mr. Levy and Ms. Regalia, had $25,000 of liability coverage, and both of those policies, American Family, had paid the limits so that Mr. Bailey got $50,000 from two underinsured motor vehicles, is there any coverage in your view under this policy?
Yes, I don't think you can say. I think you're coming close then to the same situation. Well, wait, the payments are by the drivers, excuse me, or
that's
on
right.
their behalf.
That's right. They're on behalf of two tortfeasors, both of whom are underinsured. When you compare the limits of their policy to the underinsured that Mr. Bailey had available.
If the limits are, as in this case, $50,000,
right.
and if State Farm is correct, mm-hmm. there would not be any coverage.
Well, I'm asking what you think about it, though, because now we have two UIM payers under my hypothetical. So you have two UIM payers. They are both paying $25,000. In your view,
Is there any coverage under the policy that we're looking at here?
I would think so. I haven't thought it. I was afraid you'd ask that question. And I wasn't really prepared to address it. But what is immediately troubling to me is it seems to be both absurd and harsh. And I now that you've asked the question, I think to myself, why didn't I think of that in advance of coming here? I should have.
Your position is based on each individual tortfeasor.
That's right. And the if you're dealing with the purpose, and getting back to the purpose, the court has said repeatedly that the purpose of underinsured motorists is to provide the insured with the same coverage that that person would have had if the tortfeasor had limits equivalent to the UIM limits.
And you're saying you can't add two UIM tortfeasors together?
The two together.
Well, how do you square that with the language in the statute that says any payment?
Well,
doesn't say one payment.
Things I'd like to address in that respect.
Okay.
Number one, going back to Peschendorf. I think number one, you still have to go back to the purpose. And even if the language any could be interpreted as you're now suggesting, hopefully as a devil's advocate. But in any event, I think you have to look at the purpose and see if this is really consistent with what the legislature was intending to do, whether it's harsh, unreasonable, absurd. So there's many routes, and as you well aware, the court took three different routes to arrive at the same conclusion in that case. So if you're dealing with the word any, I think it has to be taken within context of what the legislature was attempting to accomplish. In that same respect, it uses that the payment is being made for, quote, the bodily injury. And I really can't understand how the word the bodily injury could be utilized as you were suggesting. Because very carefully, and just within days before this law was enacted, the legislature changed the joint and several liability provisions. So was a very marked division as to who was responsible for what. And if we use, and it's an argument I gave up in the lower court, but the word the bodily injury treats everything as one. In regards to instructions, this court has said in the past that the cause of the accident is an inappropriate question in a special verdict because it suggests there can only be one cause. Here, if you use the cause, what Sister Regalo was paying, if she was liable at all, and that's never been determined in this case, and I think clearly State Farm doesn't care whether or not Sister Regalo was causally negligent. She would be paying for a very small portion of the bodily injury. And it's not the portion that Levy, Bailey's driver, would have been primarily responsible for. So I don't think it's fair to just pick out the word any and forget the words the bodily injury, because that's inconsistent with the any, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I asked your opposing counsel regarding the statute 632.32.5i and the language specifically for which payment is made. Can you give any information regarding the genesis of that language?
Information regarding?
How that language was inserted in the statute, how it came to be.
I have no more information than you really provided, I believe, in the Teschendorf case as to the history, as to the materials received from the Insurance Alliance and the subsequent changes in the statute.
Where in your appendix is the booklet, the policy booklet?
In my it starts page 123 in my appendix.
And goes until when? And
it goes to page 155. That includes the endorsements.
Okay. Where is the booklet?
The booklet?
Yeah. As I recall, let me just take a look. You have in your index to your appendix State Farm certifications, declaration page, policy booklet, and endorsements.
The booklet starts, if I'm understanding you, in page 126.
And goes until when?
The booklet goes page 141.
What's the difference between the booklet and the policy?
What's the difference between
the booklet? The booklet and the policy.
The booklet is the policy.
Right.
Plus the endorsements, of course.
Okay.
They're one and the same.
Yeah. So far as the page numbers I gave you, there are really two pages of the booklet to a page of the appendix.
And the booklet, you were discussing in your brief the language of the booklet then on page 133 of your brief, which is, we will pay damages for bodily injury and insured is legally entitled to collect from the owner or
driver
of an underinsured motor vehicle. I think you made the argument that that language is different than the payment reflected in the reducing clause. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
It's not dealt with in the endorsement. It's dealt with in the policy. There's a reducing clause in the policy, or on that page, as a matter of fact, that deals with reductions from damages. The endorsement changes that. But that language, which you just referred to, also comes up in Gillette, where, again, you said that the purpose of the UIM coverage was to provide the insured with the coverage that that person would have if the tortfeasor had liability limits equal to the UIM limits.
What's wrong with...
And then you don't get these reductions.
What's wrong with State Farm's argument? It seems pretty reasonable and well presented. I mean, what's wrong with that result, if anything?
Which argument?
the argument dealing with whether or not any includes the payment vis-a-vis an adequately insured tortfeasor.
I think what's wrong with that argument is multifold. Number one, I think all of this has to be taken in the context of all the cases that have dealt with this issue. Until this case in Morotz and the subsequent case Gressens, which is now reported, came onto the scene, there wasn't any case dealing with a payment in this underinsured situation by an adequately insured driver. And certainly, wherever the word any was used within the decisions, I doubt that any of the justices or judges of the appellate courts were really dealing with it within that context. The same in respect to the use of the word all sources, payment from all sources. I think as the word has been used in various decisions, it was in the context of those cases, and none of those cases were dealing with anything beyond what I believe the statute contemplated, that is reductions by the amount paid by the underinsurer on its behalf, amounts paid either by disability insurance payment or by workers' compensation payments. And the concept in that regard that you would have to disregard, if you decided this case in Bailey's favor, that somehow you'd have to disregard what the legislature specifically provided for makes no sense to me. The legislature said there'll be a reduction for workers' comp. There'll be a reduction for disability. And if that's clearly spelled out in the policy, and it's not contextually ambiguous, there's no reason why it wouldn't still be deductible. I think the problem is that this predetermined fixed level of recovery isn't really predicated upon that predetermined fixed level being a total of amounts paid by an adequately insured party. I mean, it just strikes me as harsh and absurd and makes no sense and fundamentally defeats the purpose of UAM.
How do you figure this predetermined level? The argument that is made, as I understand it, if you buy $100,000 worth of underinsured motorist coverage, let's take Morotz, for example, and it costs $19, and actuarially you figure you have to put a figure, whether it's $17 or $19, but in this case it was $19. The argument is made that it's a fixed predetermined level, and that's what you base your premium on. That's the argument that is made as far as having a fixed, what you're saying, and you may be right, is that, well, that payment has to come from an underinsured motorist, and it can't come from any other source. That's your argument. But how do you get how would you determine, you know that the level of insurance that you're buying is $100,000. You're not arguing that, are you?
Yeah. Number one, I believe that assuming a policy is not contextually ambiguous, that it can come from the underinsured or from workers' comp or from disability insurance, because the legislature has specifically provided for those.
But not from another source.
But not from another source. I just don't think all sources was ever intended to do that, or that a predetermined fixed level was really contemplating reductions from sources other than those three.
Yes. When you read the, you know, 632.32.5.I.1, that it talks about a policy may provide the limits under the policy for the underinsured motorist, I'm going to skip some, coverage for bodily injury from any one accident shall be reduced by any of the following. And then it says amounts paid for by or behalf of any person or organization that may be legally responsible for the bodily injury for which the payment is made. Now, you're saying when you read on, and it's workers' comp, and it's disability, that because they don't spell out any person or organization, you're only referring there to UIM. That's what you're referring to.
I believe so, and I believe if the legislature had contemplated including payments by adequately insured people, there would have been another subsection.
Okay.
Counsel, you also, in response to my question, said it's in response to only one UIM payer, because you wouldn't permit the addition of the two $25,000 UIM payers that I posed in my hypothetical, correct?
I believe so.
Okay. Just so I'm clear on where you are. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mrs. Strand. We'll now hear from Thomas Goss.
And this is yours.
Again, representing State Farm, Mr. Goss.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to, at the outset, correct a mistake in my comments with regard to the scope of the statute itself. When I cited the Welland case, I referred to the court at paragraph 55. And actually, there is language in paragraph 55 which supports it, but the proposition. But I meant to direct the court's attention to paragraph 56, where the court concluded, it stated, yet with stat 632.32 sub 5 sub I 1 permits reduction of limits of liability under UIM coverage only by amounts paid to the insured. And that dovetails with what the court said earlier in paragraph 46, which is really what that language, in my view, can only reasonably mean in terms of for which payment is made. We'll always give that result. I also want to, again, indicate that understanding the correct purpose of UIM coverage is extremely important. And the bulletproof gold standard for that it can apply in any case, all cases, is the one that the court articulated in Welland when it states that it provides a fixed predetermined level of recovery that's arrived at by factoring in payments made from all the described sources.
Mr. Strand's position, if I understood him, that he agrees with that. You have a fixed predetermined amount. And that amount deals with each individual underinsured tortfeasor. And that's what you bought.
Right.
I mean, that's his position. So his position is, if you have five people who are tortfeasors and they're joint tortfeasors, that under the joint and several liability, I'm not going to go into details about amounts, you, the victim, may recover only a percent from each of them. In that he wants the policy to apply to each underinsured motorist. So you do have a fixed limit to each underinsured. Now, you're objecting to that because you can then go over the amount.
Right. Yeah, it's not – and again, I think the problem – and I just want to, again, emphasize to the court that State Farm's policy – in the policy booklet that the court referred to in earlier questions with regard to 201 about definition of underinsured motorist, paragraph 2 was amended by endorsement that's found on page 214. in terms of, and that goes the limits to limits instead of the limits to damages. But what I'm saying is that what happens is you first have to, in order to advance a UIM claim, you have to have an underinsured motorist. In this case, we do. The underinsured motorist is Levy. It's not Regala, okay? So he has, he can walk through the front door in terms of coverage. Now the question is, what can he recover under that policy? And that's where the reducing clause comes in. And based on the payment of Regala has made, the answer is he recovers nothing under the policy because the purpose has been satisfied. He's been provided the guaranteed fixed level of recovery. And that's exactly what State Farm's...
I'm sorry, did you want to go?
No, I was going to say that, and that's the fixed policy that he paid insurance for. He bought, in other words, I gave the Moratz example, but it's... whatever level he had, that was reached by the payment he got.
Correct. All payments, both for the underinsured motorist and the tort, absolutely.
Counsel, if I can, the section you just referred to on page 214, item 2, that you have just asserted, took this to limits to a limits policy. Is it your contention that that paragraph has to be read in conjunction with the policy on page 201, the introductory paragraphs, the second paragraph in particular, or does it revoke that second paragraph?
And at 201, Your Honor, you're referring to?
Talking about we will pay damages for bodily injury, and insured is legally entitled to collect from the owner or driver of an underinsured motor vehicle. The bodily injury must be caused by accident arising out of the operation, maintenance, or use of an underinsured motor vehicle. Now, as I understood, this endorsement dealt with paragraph 2 that was on page 202. But I'm wondering, if you have to read the whole policy together, does this have the effect of revoking that paragraph on page 201, or does it have to be read in conjunction with that paragraph in 201? And if it has to be read in conjunction with it, does that have to do with the issue of contextual ambiguity?
The latter point, Your Honor, it has to be read in conjunction with it. In other words, you have to read all the policy provisions and apply them. If you ignore them, like the court in Gressens did, and basically what you're saying is you've got the coverage clause that say this is what we'll pay. Okay. Well, if you stop right there and ignore the other language, any exclusions that maybe apply, or the reducing clause, well, it's preordained, the result. But you can't do that.
Well, here's the problem that I'm having, and perhaps you can clarify, and I know your red light is on, so I have to keep this short, but when I read that paragraph, that seems to suggest limits to damages. When I read the reducing clause, that suggests limits to limits.
Right.
And so if you have to read them together, it would appear that to an insurer who's reading this policy, you have an internal conflict within the policy.
No, Your Honor, and I see the point now. The limits to limits is to get you into underinsured motorists in the first instance. Then once you're there, State Farm will pay, assuming you have a viable claim, we will pay the damages. That's what limits your recovery. We don't pay limits at that point. We pay damages that you prove that arise out of the tortious conduct of the underinsured motorist. So it is different.
But you agree to pay the damages that are caused by the underinsured motor vehicle.
That's right. Right. That's the
percent of the total damages.
No, the damages. I mean, you have to have a viable claim. If you don't have a viable claim, you're not going to get any recovery anyway, regardless of limits or reducing clauses. If you have a viable claim, you still might not get any recovery if you've already recovered the limits. So what I'm saying is, you know, while in this case it triggers a UIM claim, there is no recovery because of the fact that the payments received are in excess of the limit. So, and again, this isn't. The court in Gressens, the Court of Appeals, made a huge mistake by just looking at the granting the coverage clause to the exclusion of the reducing clause. And I, in my principal brief, I cited the case of Gonzalez versus City of Franklin, which is 137 with second 109, which I would commend to the court to consider, because that's 20 years ago where this court basically applied contextual liability for the identical claim, where they looked at just it was just a reverse, because the coverage clause in that case saved the result that the insured was trying to, or in that case the plaintiff was trying to argue, that because the court said we can't look at these things in isolation. We have to look at them as whole. And when we look at them as whole, it ties it all together. And you do have the internal consistency, which I believe is present here.
Could you restate, counsel?
Yes.
Could you please restate exactly what language in the Teschendorf case that you find problematic?
Oh, the language I find in Teschendorf, I think it was earlier, was going back to that prior purpose, that it's the purpose of UIM coverage is to place the insured in the same position he or she would have been had the tortfeasor's limits been the same as the UIM limits. I have a problem. And I think as long as the court goes down that road, there's going to be continuous problems. And I can see why, again, in context, if we just look at, if we're just talking about payments made by an underinsured motorist, that's a fair assessment. But the reality is, when we go beyond that, it's not. And mine's saying the definition that it's a fixed level of recovery arrived at by providing payments from all sources will always apply. And that's the gold standard. And if you stay on that track, you'll be in good shape.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Your red light is on. We're going to conclude the State Farm versus Travis Bailey. This is case number 2003-AAP-2482. The court's going to take a brief recess at this time, and then we're going to come back. We'll let the students go out and perhaps a new group come in. All right, thank you. And thank you, counsel, for an interesting argument on a subject which the court always likes to have up here. So thank you.